Welcome to another episode of The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens, and on today's episode, we talk with Dr. Jason Jones. Jason is a keynote speaker, trainer, and author of the recent book, Activator, which is about helping leaders understand the neuroscience so that they can lead their best. What I love about Jason is his ability to take these concepts of brain science and behavioral science, but make it practical so that we can all understand it and apply it and understand what's happening in ourselves and in our teams as we go through this working relationship and our working environment. So it's a great conversation. Hope you enjoy it. And let's get started. Jason, how are you, sir? It's good to have you here.
I'm great, Matt. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. I've gotten to know you a little bit over the last couple of years. And for those that don't know Jason, Jason's a PhD, but like what I love about you, Jason, the reason why I get excited about your work and what you do is you can break down the psychology that of the brain. You can break down like our ability to understand neuroscience without being a neuroscientist, but to bring that psychology and make it so practical for us to understand, like over the course of our friendship and relationship, I've learned so much from you about how the brain works, how we interact, and how we can apply that. And so I'm really just interested, if you don't mind like sharing, like what got you into this? Like what got you so interested in the brain, and how'd you figure out a way to apply it so practically for the rest of us?
Yeah. Thanks for that question, actually, because it, for me, it's a bit of my history of my evolution in not only my profession and career, but also in my understanding and growth of leadership. And so, you know, you go back to graduate school, and I was working on a graduate degree, a master's, and then a doctoral degree in the late 1990s, the early 2000s, and defended a dissertation in 2003. And at that time, everything was focused on behavior. Mm-hmm. Everything was behavior. In fact, we were just coming out of, or actually still very much in a period in the business world of, if we want to make something happen, the results we get, it's all behavior driven. So what that meant was everybody relied mainly on B.F. Skinner's theories around reinforcement, right? So it was like, reward people, throw money at people, you know, do things like that, appreciate people, and you're going to get what you want. Well, over the next, you know, several years, probably 5 years or so, as I graduated and kind of came out of a great program in psychology, but began to think more broadly and more practically about how we interact and bring out the best in people in the workplace, it was apparent to me that just rewards and just behaviorism did not do the trick. In fact, it became very expensive, and it, you know, reward satiates, and, you know, people then look at other places to go find the better deal, or maybe even worse, people stay and they become entitled. They expect something more and more, right?
Preach.
So to me, yeah, to me in my brain, I'm thinking there's got to be something more here. And that's where I began to explore. And this happened to be a time where we had explosive growth in the area of neuroscience. Mid to late 2000s, we had more and more technology that allowed us to better understand the brain. And then we had great researchers. And you know, Boyatzis and Jack up at Case Western Reserve University, and many others, but them in particular are a couple that I've really followed. We're now using functional MRI machines and looking at the brain, the activity, and better understanding people in their work environment, not just in a lab. And that's what intrigued me, Matt. That's where I went, man, there's something here. And I began the journey probably around 2007-08 and to better understand how the brain works. What does this mean? And how do we merge? Because there's good stuff in behavioral science, but how do we merge that with the neuroscience and what actually fits together and what doesn't, right? And there's some things in behavioral science that don't quite fit the brain science. And there's also things that does fit perfectly and has enhanced our understanding of the behavior science. And I can talk about a little bit of those, especially here in a little bit, especially around communication and some of the just amazing things we're learning about how people communicate that we didn't know 15 or 20 years ago, but now we know just a little bit about, and it's so intriguing. And I believe will be the future of how we communicate and how we lead when we look back on this in 2050 and 2075 and 2100, right?
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating. So that's pretty much how I got into this. And then I've spent the last 10 years or so really digging deep into this and getting to know people in the industry that are working in this area, partnering, reading, and then applying these principles in the workplace.
Well, I absolutely want to get into that because that's some of the fascinating work that I've seen you do. And I want to talk about, and again, like I said, you know, you just said, you know, you talked a lot about there about behavior science and brain science, but again, what I think you do really, really well, and what's been impactful for me to understand too, as I've learned from you, is that being able to take those scientific concepts, mm-hmm. but apply it to everyday business, because that's not really something we do easily or naturally as people. I feel like we kind of put up these barriers between those, you know. It's like, mm-hmm. you can study, like you said, you can study these things in a lab and, you know, maybe we'll understand a little bit more, but like, how do I apply that to the team I lead and the business I'm running and those dynamics? And so, so I'm excited to get into that, but I want to, as we talk about that, you've got a new book here. It's the second one that you've written. My favorite one so far, no offense to your first one. This one's the bomb. I like it. But Activator, using brain science to boost motivation, deepen engagement, and supercharge performance. And if you're seeing here on the video, I got my own signed copy. So this isn't just some shameless plug for it. But I really, really love it. Tell, if you would, just tell the folks that are listening, like, what does it mean to be an activator?
Yeah. So that's a really popular question, right? You know, what is this concept of activation or activator that I talk so much about? And to put it succinctly for you and the audience, an activator is a leader who understands how to leverage the neuroscience to energize their people, to help them, to launch them towards their greatest potential, to be their best, right? So really it is a leader who has insights and then has tools and has implemented behaviors into their leadership, daily leadership practices that allows them to turn on, to activate the brains of the people that they work with to help them optimize their best selves and their brain. And by the way, all the stuff where you hear people talk about, you know, people being their best selves and people performing highly and reaching their potential, you know, that is all in the brain. Mm-hmm. It starts in the brain, right? So that's what this idea of activator is. It's about how you as a leader can be more than an influencer. You know, a lot of people talk about leadership is influence, and I think that's great. I think that's fine because there's lots a part of leadership being about influence. However, my feeling is influence is a little passive. The connotation is a little passive. I believe the best leaders are activators. And notice the key word or key portion of that word, active, right? And what activators do is they take specific action and they know what behaviors to put into place with their people that turns their brain on, that lights them up. And then those people, they're more motivated. They want to engage in their work and it boosts their level of performance.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that was fascinating for me kind of reading and thinking about, like, as I'm trying to, you know, talk through and apply some of the principles you talked about. And I don't want to butcher this. So correct me where I'm wrong, but you told a little bit of a story about how they've looked at people's brains. And when somebody is recalling a story from somebody that they've deemed a good leader in their head, and they say, they've asked to like retell a story, they can see that more than 14 parts of the brain kind of light up in the test they're doing. But when you do that same test with somebody and talk about a bad boss, it's like 5 or 6 parts of the brain act up. So there's this true reaction that's happening in your brain. Did I get that story right?
I don't want to tear it up. Now, this is the research of Anthony Boyatzis and Richard Boyatzis and Anthony Jack, Case Western Reserve University. And they looked at these fMRIs, and it's different than an MRI because an MRI gives you these pictures. fMRI gives you like a video, like these moving pictures. So lots of fast pictures taken. So you can see literally the electrical energy of a person's brain and blood flow in the brain. And that lets us know kind of what's turned on, right? What's mm-hmm. being activated. And in this research study, they sat workers down, employees down, and they said, we want you to recall experiences with your boss. Now, those people who recall certain experiences with their supervisors that were supportive, that were their boss kind of empowered them, talked about their dreams, their goals. So they were goal-oriented coaching type of conversations. It lit up 14 areas of the brain. And these are areas that we want the brain lit up at work, right? Mm-hmm. These are areas like emotional control, creativity, analysis, ability to analyze and make good decisions. And these are frontal cortex. These are uniquely human areas that makes us really good at what we do, it helps us to become high performers and locks us in and gives us that great focus. Now, here's the bad thing. The bad part of this is that the contrast are those employees that talked about their experiences with their supervisor being ones where the supervisor was controlling, demanding, condescending, not connecting. Those people only had 6 areas activated. And here's the kicker, 11 areas were deactivated. So essentially what they saw in the fMRIs is that there was electrical activity in some of these areas that we want them to have this, and it actually shut down.
Yeah, it had the complete opposite effect, not just no effect, but the
absolutely
opposite.
And you know, we've all experienced this, right? Have you been in a situation where you got bad news, or someone put you on the spot, or you know, you were embarrassed, and your brain kind of shuts down, right? You might even freeze. Some people go in the fight or flight or freeze mode, and it's because what's going on is you've been in a state of threat in that situation, and it yep. shuts down the areas that you don't need for that higher level thinking. Yep. And then it shifts the blood flow and the electrical activity into the areas, guess what, that are activated. These are the areas of things like our defense mechanism of how do we compete? How do we win? How do we protect ourselves? Now, is that what you want in a collaborative environment?
Of course not.
Probably not, right? Now, maybe a coach out on a sports field that's yelling at someone and maybe having some of those conversations, that might help because it raises cortisol, right? Mm-hmm. And cortisol actually gives you some focus, but it also, and it makes you kind of focus in that area of aggression and protection and things like that. But that's not healthy and really conducive for cooperation, collaboration, and high performance in a work setting.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we just heard was kind of what I've been trying to explain very early on so far, is that you can take these concepts and really help people understand really what's going on. Because in the example that you just described, you know, my non-PhD public school education, you know, sort of mind, you can see those things happening with like physical body gestures, right? So if you're talking about a previous boss that you did not have good experiences with, you see people's shoulders kind of slump. You see their mood change. You see their facial expressions change. Versus when you talk about one of these great leaders you had, and people light up and they'll sit and tell you for days all the great things that this person does. But what's very interesting is to learn not just what you see, that like the physical outside, but to learn what's actually happening in your brain and why that happens. And why, like you said, when we're really coming down on somebody for a bad performance, or you're delivering it poorly, mm-hmm. people aren't, the team that you're working with, if you're that type of leader, they're not even hearing you. They're not even hearing you because 5 seconds in, they're in fight or flight and they've stopped. And I've been in those situations myself where, yep. you know, you feel like you're not being supported or all those things are coming and you completely Absolutely. Shut down.
And I talk a lot about this in my book, especially in those critical communication times, like when you're giving constructive feedback to an employee. And if you don't set that up correctly and do some of the things right, and you've what I like to call earn the right, mm-hmm. and you earn the right through a track record of connection. Mm-hmm. And connection is one of the skills that what I teach in how to become an activator. And you got to do that before you can even think that you're going to give constructive feedback and someone's not going to go into fight or flight and the defense walls go up.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to might ask you something that's kind of difficult here because, there's a lot of information in your book and your study and the research that's been out there. But if you could kind of break down for the audience, you know, what it means to be an activator, this idea in, I don't know, two or three, four sort of core principles.
Sure.
How would you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's an outstanding question because, you know, any book that you get that's, you know, 200, 300 pages, it's nice to be able to have a way to just think about this so you can take it back and apply it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here's the thing. There are a lot of leadership competencies out there. I mean, go look up, go Google leadership competencies, and you're going to find dozens upon dozens of them. And then many organizations have leadership competencies, and in and of themselves, they're good. And they also allow us to understand ourselves better, know where our strengths and weaknesses are. Where we're seeing a problem with this, and many of my clients have expressed this to me, and many people in the audiences that I speak to have expressed this to me, and that is there are so many of these competencies. It's like, where do I start? And it's overwhelming whenever people tell me I got to develop 24 competencies, you know, to be a good leader. And we've kind of been overwhelmed in many ways with competencies and leadership competencies for growth and development. Here's what I've done in my book. I have broken this down into looking at the behavioral and the brain science. And I have broke this down into three key overarching competencies. And these three things, these three skills, I implore leaders to focus on these three things daily. All the other things that are going on will fall into place. But if you focus and you grow yourself in these three areas daily, this is going to be what's going to help you to be an activator and to be putting into practice the neuroscience principles. And also, it's a whole lot easier to focus on three things than it is on 24 or 36 Absolutely. Or 48, right? So here's the three things. The first one is connecting. The first skill is connecting. How do we connect with our people? And I like to call this cultivating trust through relationships. And you can call this connection, you can call it relationship building, you know, or, you know, trust building, that sort of thing. But I like to call it connecting because this is an easy way for us to think about what our brains do. We literally can connect with others. And I can talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but I want to let everybody know what the other two are so we don't go down that road, that tangent, but we can go deeper.
I got some things I want to talk to you about that, but yeah, absolutely. Okay. Hit me with the other two.
So connecting again is cultivating trust through relationships. The second thing is coaching. It's a coaching skill, and a coaching skill is a set of skills, but overarching a method for how we facilitate high performance with backbone and heart.
Okay.
How we like balance that. Which most leaders don't do that very well. They're better on one side than the other, right?
There's coaching going on, but it's not with backbone and heart.
Yeah. So the third one is culturing. Okay. And culturing is setting and upholding standards of excellence. And so as a leader, what I break all of the neuroscience down into in my book is how to actually put into practice and grow these three skills and do it on a daily basis. If you're a leader and you focus on these three things every day, how do I keep I build connection and trust with people? How do I coach people? How do I really, what it is today in today's day and age, how you facilitate high performance is not through delegation and command and control, right? Mm-hmm. It is through facilitating high performance, through facilitating people reaching their goals, which is the coaching. And then that third piece, which is focusing on your culture as well. And what are you doing to make sure the standards you've set are clear and you're upholding those and you're getting people around you to help you uphold those, right? It's co-creating a culture, not writing the culture down on a piece of paper saying, this is what our values are. This is what our behaviors. Now everybody go do it.
Exactly.
Or how do I get buy-in for it? Instead, it's a different perspective that I share, which is brain-based. People do things and they fall in love with things and movements, right? When they feel like they're a part of it and they've contributed to it. And that's why I say culturing, and I use the ing on there, We're not talking about as culture. It is an everyday practice, right, of co-creating the standards of excellence within our team, within our organization.
I was going to ask you why the ING, and that makes perfect sense. But Jason, it's surprising to me how many leaders leave culture up to chance. You know, they just sort of expect it to happen in this magnificent way that people are going to write about, 20 years from now, without taking those specific steps to build it, to create it together, to sustain it, to have a little bit of accountability, right, towards doing it. What advice or tips do you have there for somebody who's maybe stuck in a culture that they know they need to change? Like, what's our way to sort of get out of it, or to activate our teams to do culturing?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you need to understand, every leader needs to understand that you don't force culture. Mm-hmm. Culture is created by everyone in the culture, right? So, and this is a mindset shift, because if you're a dictator, you're going to go in and you're going to say, this is what's going to happen and everybody better do it, or here's the consequences. But you know what? Today's day of work and what we expect, and the level of talent that we have, and the freedom that's and autonomy that's desired, people won't stand for that. They won't buy into it. And if they do, you're actually getting subpar performance likely from those people, mm-hmm. and they're sticking around, and you probably don't want that, right?
Absolutely.
And it becomes difficult to lead that. So leaders, first of all, need to understand that they have to co-create this together. And I've worked with some leaders and some teams, organizations that I've worked with them to actually deconstruct and then reconstruct. We actually talk about it that way. Let's deconstruct our current culture. What do we like and what do we not like? Mm-hmm. And what do we want to get rid of? And what do we like? And now let's rebuild this together and facilitate that as a team. Now, you can use a facilitator, Matt, like you or I, who have experience doing this type of thing, but leaders can also do this on their own as well. And I give some pointers in my book on some of these things, on how a leader can be a facilitator and have some discussions around this. But culturing is made up of five core areas, and these are research-based. And I talk about them in my book. I even have a checklist for this, so that you can, and I could tell your audience as well, where you can go and get this checklist without even having to buy the book, but the book will help you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That checklist absolutely. Under each of these five areas, I call it the frame. And how do you frame your culture? How do you frame your environment? And it's five things. The frame stands for, the F is freedom, R is relationships, the A is ability, the M is meaningfulness, and the E is energy. Now, this is built on self-determination theory, which if you've read Daniel Pink's book, Drive, that whole book is really based, and most of everything he talks about is Desi and Ryan, Rochester University researchers and psychologists who've been working on this idea of self-determination theory for literally four decades.
Wow.
Okay. And it's the most contemporary, that and Stephen Reese's basic desires theory. Those are the most contemporary theories on motivation that we know of right now, and how it helps us, how when we support this motivation, it encourages people to make the choice to engage in their work and want to engage in their work, right? So freedom, that's pretty easy to think about. We all want freedom. We want autonomy in our work. The better, the more freedom we have with flexibility, the more we're going to buy in. This is like a pillar of motivation and engagement. It's got to be a pillar of a great culture. Relationships is, can we count on other people? Do people care about us? Do we work together well? Are we supported? Ability is really competence. And that is, how do we feel about our ability to get our work done, to reach our goals? And it's got to be a balance. It can't be too hard. We can't sit around and think, oh my gosh, we're never going to reach this goal. But it also can't be too easy and we're not challenged.
Exactly. Yeah.
Either one of those doesn't optimize our motivation and help our culture. And then the M is for meaningfulness. And here's the thing, and Matt, we could have a whole nother program on meaningfulness. Too many speakers, too many leadership writers or gurus talk about meaningfulness or motives. And they say, you know, you gotta know what motivates your people, or, you know, you gotta find what's meaningful to them. And they make it, they don't have a way to explain that. They don't have a way. And so oftentimes it goes back to the default, which is that you're making a difference in the world. You know, yeah. that you're helping someone, that you're, and it's this default, really higher, you know, very overarching idea of meaningfulness. Here's what we know from the science. And that is, there are 16 core areas that encompass our values and our motives, and there are intrinsic motives. And we all have different levels of intensity of these 16 areas. And in these levels of intensity, this is what defines for us the sense of meaningfulness we get from certain activities. It's why we pursue certain activities, because we're pursuing a sense of living out our values that creates a sense of meaningfulness. I talk about that in my book as well. Certainly don't have enough time to go into that here.
No, we could talk for an hour about that
in the book. And in fact, Matt, here's what's really cool about this, and that I really want people to understand, managers to understand, and that is, with this frame, when you're facilitating the meaningfulness, this goes back to the coaching skill. Mm-hmm. If you learn how to do this and you read the book, you're going to learn how to help leaders have coaching conversations that identifies what's meaningful to a person and then aligns that with what their work is and what their team goals are and what their organization mission is.
So
is that powerful or what?
Oh, it's super powerful. And I think everything you said is accurate, right? We talk about meaningfulness and purpose, and we talk about it oftentimes very generically, right? So how does somebody, I think the challenge that a lot of leaders have is when you start saying, like, let's say they go to a speaker and the speaker says, you know, you need to find the purpose that your team has, right? And we keep it high level, right? And so they go back and they try to have that conversation, like, what's really important to this person? How do I connect with them? But that person that they're talking with has that same sort of high level idea of what's meaningful to them. Like, how do you, as a leader or a coach or a friend, like, how do you help somebody else find their own meaning? How do you help them self-identify it when maybe they're stuck in this high level?
Sure. And it's first of all, it's good to preface this answer with the fact that we know study after study has shown that the most powerful, the most influential mechanism, cultural piece, if you will, of engagement in a team or organization is the employee supervisor relationship. Mm-hmm. In fact, Gallup, in a study just 3 years ago, they came out and said they, according to their data, that they can attribute 70% of the variance of engagement of an individual in the workplace. 70% of variance of that is based on the supervisor-employee relationship. Okay. And so it's important that leaders understand that their number one job is, and too many leaders, I hate the term working manager, because what this implies is that you're a manager of a set of people, but you also have a whole bunch of individual contribution that you have to give. What ends up happening is they focus on the individual contribution and they don't function as managers and leaders of their team, right? A manager's job, and if you're a middle manager listening to this or watching this, if you're a high level manager, like you're an executive leader in your organization, I want to tell you, you want to make a jump in terms of leadership effectiveness in your company. You need to make the number one, and you need to hire on this, and you need to reinforce around this and reward around this, that the number one job of a manager and a leader is to facilitate each employee reaching their individual goals and those accumulating up to a team goal. A manager's job, almost all of it, if not all of it, should be how every day am I helping every individual on my team be successful. It'd be like a teacher that has a class of 10 people, and their job is every day, how do I make sure each person gets an A? It's that simple.
Absolutely.
Imagine if a teacher had a job where they had to teach children and the goal is to get an A, but also they had to be a janitor and they had to cook food for lunch, all that stuff. We would look at that and go, that's stupid, right?
Yeah.
But we do that to managers all the time. And we wonder why we have so many problems with the manager-employee relationship and engagement. Now, back to your question. Sorry, I belabored that.
I feel
just a little bit strongly about it, as you can tell. So here's what I would say. With that as a backdrop, the job of a leader, of anyone who's in a type of management or leadership position, you want to get to know your people well enough so you know their strengths and weaknesses. So you see them in action. So you're talking and having conversations. You're connecting with them at the level where you now can understand what their more intrinsic motives are and values are. And I explain that, how to do that in my book. And then you can begin to have conversations and you can bring that out of people. I talk about in coaching this idea of commending. Not praising people. Everybody's heard, oh, thank you. Well done. Yeah. Very good. Appreciate you. No. And I teach specifically how to do this. Have a statement, say something to someone, Matt, I appreciate the way that you handled that customer. You have amazing level of patience. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. Matt, thank you for the way you stayed late and worked with the team to make sure we got that project out. Your level of commitment and the ability to support others is off the charts. I appreciate that in you. Now, those types of things are now beginning to get to that person's values. It reinforces that and it helps us then be able to begin to connect. What makes that person feel good? What makes that person feel fulfilled?
Jason, I feel better right now that you just gave me those compliments. So thank you. I mean, I didn't stay late, but you're right. It does. It's so much more impactful than just some generic, hey, yep, thanks for the work on that. You know,
and what you're doing here, the basis of this is what you're doing here is you are, and this is a brain thing, Matt. Okay. Think about this. If we want to reinforce someone from three parts of the brain, there is the lizard part of the brain, the reptile part of the brain. If you put your hand together like this, you know, and those of you who are just listening to this, make a fist. If you look at your, essentially the bottom of your hand and your wrist, that's your brain stem. That area is responsible for you staying alive. It runs your heartbeat. It runs your breathing. It runs your fight or flight, all that stuff, right? People lead from there. We've actually led from there. We motivate people by telling them we're going to kill them or we're going to hurt them or we're going to fire them. And yep, that's where we're trying to lead people from the lizard or the reptilian brain. Now, if you open your hand up and you put your thumb inside your hand, okay, that's the middle part of your brain. That part of the brain, we know that's the mammalian part of the brain. And the mammalian part of the brain is highly effective for reinforcement, for understanding and being able to know how to behave related to pleasure and pain, right? And so what happens is we've done this now for really the past 1,500 years in what we'd call more of a professional environment within a workplace. We begin to lead from the middle part of the brain, right? And that middle part of the brain is all about reward. And so what we're doing is we're telling people, oh, great job, way to go. And we're lighting that part up a little bit, but it's like we're dogs. We're treating people like dogs and animals. Mm-hmm. And we're thinking, you know, if I throw them a treat, they're going to keep doing what I want them to do.
Yeah, exactly.
The problem is that doesn't work long-term. It satiates and we go, okay, yeah, whatever. Now fold that, all your fingers over your thumb inside your fist. What's on the outside, all your fingers, that is the cortex. That makes us unique as humans, okay? So not only do we have this cortex, okay, primates have a cortex as well, but here's the really cool thing. At the front of it is the prefrontal cortex. That's the executive function. That's our personality. That's our ability to think ahead. It's our ability to think about meaningfulness and why we want to do something that hurts us or harms us or is uncomfortable now. But we think about, oh, I'll do this now because it's going to give me something great in the future. It's going to have a great payoff. This is why I will take care of my children now because what I see and envision in them in the future. Why I go and take a class now or I work on a degree now after work when it's really hard and I want to just go, you know, lay down on the couch and eat and watch TV the rest of the night. Instead, I work hard because our frontal brain says, you know what? There's value and meaning in doing something hard, right? So here's the thing. Whenever we commend people and we value them for their character, not just for what they do, but who they are and what they value. We see in them what they value and what they contribute, but that's in a way that is a part of who they are, their personality, their character, that lights up that part of the brain. And it helps people to realize, you know what? I'm more than just a worker to this person, to my boss. I'm more than just someone. I'm more than just a servant or someone who's making someone rich in their job. This person actually sees in me my uniqueness. And that's what's really cool about the activation method is, and that's what I call this, Matt, is the activation leadership method. When you put it all together, it helps and empowers leaders to be able to bring out the uniqueness in their people and then leverage that. And when people see their leader doing that, it's extremely powerful in their life. In fact, there is not very many other people in most people's lives that is as uniquely positioned to understand, to see, and then to bring out and be able to place employees into a place where they can find more meaningfulness and find more alignment in their life. And that would be with their work, right?
Exactly.
So leaders have a great opportunity to bring this out in their people.
So I agree they have an opportunity to do it, but I think, you know, you're also making the case, and I would argue as well too, they have a responsibility to do that, you know, and we have Absolutely. A responsibility as leaders to, I'm going to go back just a little bit earlier when you were talking about that 70% of, you know, the 70% impact that leaders can have on their team. And some of this just comes down to like literally spending time with the people you lead and focusing your efforts there versus, like you said, all these other things, this working manager, other things that I could be doing. An organization that I worked with in the past, who they made tremendous strides on getting their leadership teams with their people. But when they first kind of started these efforts, they looked at how much time their leaders were spending with their direct reports. And Jason, it was like 15% of the time. So yep. In 15% of your day, if you work an 8-hour day, you know, you're spending an hour at most with a team of 10 or 15 of people that you might be leading. Like, that's literally minutes that you're spending with your team, which should be, I believe, your number one priority in leadership, to develop them and to help them succeed and to push them and coach them and all those types of things. You can't do that without that time piece.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the mark or the level of performance of a leader should be based on the level of performance of their people. And it's very well said. A much different way of thinking about that. And based on what you said there, Matt, and just kind of as a follow-up, Harvard Business has a great article they put out maybe 2 years ago, maybe it was 2019, early 2019, maybe 2018. And it was called the Absentee Manager. And in the research that they had done, they looked and they saw one of the top complaints of employees is that their manager was not available or approachable.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it really, and we wonder why only 34% of employees in the US are engaged. We wonder why only 15% of employees worldwide are engaged. We wonder why 70%, according to Gallup, 70% of people don't like their jobs.
Yeah.
Pretty sad, isn't it?
It is. Leaders can do something about it. And I like how you said earlier when we were talking about, I think it was meaningfulness or energy, you said, you know, like you, the brain and people, we have to sort of make this choice to engage in our mm-hmm. work, whether it's a conscious decision or it's subconscious, but we're making that choice. And I think leaders have to make the choice to put in the work with their team. Yeah. And you know, where we spend our time, this is something I'm really big at in talking about with my work is we have choices in every single thing that we do. We have so many choices every day that if we really sat down and actually wrote them down, like we'd fill up entire journals worth of choices that we made that day. And sometimes those choices are how we respond to something that happened to us that we had no control over, right? Take last year as example. Mm-hmm. Nobody had the choice of COVID hurting their business or, you know, shutting it down or anything like that, right? But we did have the choice in how we were going to respond to that. And I think there's a lot of leaders that need to sort of reset and reframe the choices that they're making in order to make the choice to be there for your people, make the choice to allocate more time to them. And then I actually heard a great speaker talk earlier this week at a live event I was doing. Have the courage to stop doing some things. Make the choice to stop doing some things so that you can make the time for your people.
Absolutely. And that actually is a great segue to the last of the frame. We almost forgot.
We didn't even talk about it. Yeah, we didn't even talk about energy.
And that's great segue to that though, Matt, because the E is energy. And what this is about is, what are you bringing to the environment? What are you cultivating or in culturing that is bringing positive, healthy energy into your team, into your organization? And what positive, healthy energy is, people don't realize, leaders don't realize, you bring a chemical environment into the group that you're in, right? You bring a chemistry in. And if you're bringing the wrong type of chemistry, it brings down the chemistry of the people around you. We are all working like chemical sets, right?
We've all heard that, right? You know, somebody comes in
and adrenaline, which is stress and stress hormones, and it's unhealthy, right? And then we don't like to be in that. Well, other people carry with them more of the dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin, which dopamine, serotonin, this is the feel-good chemicals, right? Mm-hmm. And then oxytocin is the bonding hormone that actually it builds trust. It makes us want to trust others. There's some great studies around this, around oxytocin, where they actually shot oxytocin up people's noses and they want to actually be more giving and helpful to others, right? And they also looked at oxytocin levels in certain employment environments, and they find that certain interactions creates greater oxytocin, connective type of things, energetic environments where we collaborate in a healthy, energetic way. But here's what I want to say about energy too, that we cannot forget. And it's why I love your perspective on things, Matt. And that is, energy is also where we can say, you know what, let's have some fun. Let's not forget that we are people and we're humans. And one of the great ways that we connect and that we actually light up the brain is through laughter. It's through smiling at each other. And now we have the neuroscience that actually tells us that just by smiling at someone, you can increase and improve their neurochemistry. That's so crazy.
I don't think it's crazy. No, I actually don't, because that makes a ton of sense. And I hope people take away from the fact, one, smile at more people. But what I also heard you say, Jason, there is that we should be injecting oxytocin up through people's noses, because sign me up. Like, I'll be first in line for that shot. If it's going to make me, you know, even more happy and ready to help people, like I'm now
I have to warn everybody because you can go on eBay and they actually sell.
Are you serious?
Spray.
No.
People know, which is really dangerous.
Yeah, no.
Especially
okay.
in the dating
Don't do
world.
That.
That can be a really dangerous thing in the dating world, you know, but we won't go there on that. But, let me just warn everyone that those things, that they're bunk.
Okay? Yeah. Yeah. No. If anybody's listening to this and they go and buy that, that's their own responsibility for not understanding a joke. So look, we've actually been talking for a pretty long time, and I don't want to end things, but, one of the things I want to go back to that we didn't necessarily maybe get to talk about that I'm very, very interested in and was this concept of connecting, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. And I liked how you said cultivating trust through relationships.
Yeah.
And I'm personally on this big kick right now. I've been there for a long time, but I'm on this kick of, especially with what we've all gone through in this last year and working differently and not getting as much, you know, human connection in ways that we were accustomed to in the past, of maybe gathering in large groups or going to a concert or being at work over the, you know, going to get a cup of coffee, something like that. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people that are just eager to connect more, are eager to build these relationships. And at the same time, the thing that I get stuck on a little bit is like this world, our access to the world is so big these days. You know, it's 6-7 billion people large because of the internet. And so sometimes we get caught trying to find maybe the right relationships or the ones that will support us, the ones that will nourish us, give us the energy, the ones that will that we can help develop other people. So when you say like cultivating trust through relationships, what are the ways in which we can build up those types of relationships so they can be beneficial in those working relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I like the way you're approaching this idea of the broad, right? And we have to really be careful. I coach people around just the idea of we only have a certain amount of time. We also only have a certain amount of focus as well, right? And to this day and age, we are really, there's an invitation that is hard to turn down. And that is you can try to have relationships and try to connect with more people than we ever had before.
Absolutely.
Right? Yep. Through social media and video and, you know, just so many ways to connect. And what it's done with many relationships, it's made them, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep.
Yep.
And I really try to implore leaders to really think about what your relationships are, who you need to develop these relationships with, and how to be intentional about developing those relationships. Now, in connection, I talk about, you know, three core areas of connection: how we care for people, our character. That's the other C, and the other C is our communication.
Oh, so you went three C's. There you go.
That's three C's.
You're keeping
there.
It easy. You're keeping it easy.
And there was other three C's with the connecting, coaching, and culturing. So, you know, C's is that's the letter of the day for us today. Yeah. But character has to do with what are you bringing in terms of how are you interacting with people? What do they see in you? Because it is your values put into action, you know? And if you do not have the character, if you're not doing what you said you're going to do, if you're not dependable, if, you know, you're not available, we talked about that already, right? If you're not approachable, if you're not being responsible, if, you know, you're not, even things like punctuality, right? You don't show up for meetings on time. You're communicating what you value to people. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, you communicate the fact that they're not valuable to you. Yep. And that kills connection. And this is why it's so important for earning your right to coach people well and give feedback and help people, right? Is to be able to make sure that you are coming to the table as your best self with a high level of character. It's the intent you show up with. If you show up with intent, we pick up on that.
Absolutely.
In fact, that's a part of some of the things I teach in neuroscience is the fact that when you show up, if you have alternative motives, we now know our brains communicate with other brains in ways we don't even know. We Yep. used to know it was through small facial expressions. And we talked about that a lot. Like our amygdala can pick up small emotional facial expressions and body movements. Now, Matt, this is the future. When I said the future of neuroscience and work, this is the future of neuroscience and work. This is what we're going to look back at 2050 and, you know, 2100, and we're going to go, man, we didn't know anything, right? and it's the fact that our brains communicate in a way that we don't even know. It's subconscious, but yet they're still communicating with each other. Now, some of this has to do through hormones and neurochemicals. We know that's the fact through pheromones. We learned that a few decades ago. Mm-hmm. We learned two decades ago now, we learned about these things called mirror neurons. And mirror neurons is the reason why you yawn when someone else yawns. Did you ever wonder that?
Oh, yeah.
Why is yawning contagious? There are specific types of neurons in our brain that is millennia old. It's a survival technique that allows us to mimic those who are around us so we fit in and we're trusted by them and we're not their enemy, okay? So mirror neurons, we smile when others smile, right? We laugh when others laugh. In fact, mirror neurons help us, like when you just hear laughing, it becomes contagious. That's your mirror neurons are kicking in, right? But now we know there's more complexity to it. And this is why, like with the chemical environment, you can literally, you've heard this concept before. Someone came up with this years ago before they knew this, but they said, you can smell something that's rotten. You could smell a snake, you know, you could smell someone who has a hidden agenda. Now, neuroscientists pretty much believe you actually can smell it. We just don't know we can smell it.
Yeah, we just don't know we can. Well, yeah, it's like intuition. Yeah, it's the intuition, right?
And so this all sounds like an ESP, extrasensory.
Perception.
That's it.
Extrasensory. Is that right? I don't even know.
I know. I
that's the problem with acronyms is we forget what the words actually are. We just say, oh, yeah, ESP.
But where we sit right now, we think of things like that as ESP or something just really weird, right? And now we're learning more and more. This may be another sense of how people perceive things. And we're just now learning about it. That's the power of the brain. Think about a football team, baseball team, actually football team and basketball team is much better. They've gone the whole game and they haven't really played well together, but somehow not huddling, not getting together for a timeout in the last minute, they are able to put it together and perform and come back and win a game. The best teams do that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Why are they able to do that? Because there is a communication that is happening real time, and we call that chemistry, right? We have certain relationships with people, and it's chemistry, whether it's romantic or not romantic, right? Friendship, it's chemistry. Those are the insights that now we have in neuroscience. And so now how do we use that? You go back to your real quickly to answer your question about the connecting. We need to harness what we know now. Right now, the words that we use are powerful. The phrases that we use are powerful for connecting with people. And I talk about this in my book, great research around the words that you use can literally change someone's perspective and their performance on certain things. Great research around this and a lot of fun. We can prime people's brains to go into a situation and actually be more confident, less nervous, to be to actually perform higher and to feel better about their situation.
I've seen the book, so I know that there's a lot of these words that we can use, but do you have a favorite one? Do you have one that like people really need to start putting into their vocabulary?
There's no favorite one. It's hard to kind of bring a favorite one out, right? I do see people smile a lot when I use the word strong and brave. And notice I'm using some words. Strong is a little bit more mainstream, but when you use the word, you know, brave, when we use the word, positivity is more mainstream, but if we can use more like enthusiastic, when we use words that are not as mainstreamed or
not
more novel,
our
brain attunes to novelty, right? Mm-hmm. So things that we can bring out that's more novel, and think about that. So I've got a lot of words in there you can look at and say, this is a word I want to inject more into my conversations with people. And this is great for salespeople, for sales teams. You can literally change a person's perspective, build trust with them, connect with them through the words that you use with them and the phrases as well.
I love it, man. Jason, I think we're close to an hour. I don't know. I could keep going because I'm fascinated with this. I'm fascinated with this topic. I mean, there's the smallest amount of sort of brain science that I use in my work. And you know, you obviously take it to such a higher level, but the practicality of it and how we can apply it. I mean, literally people can grab the book Activator and it's going to give them some things that they can deploy right away. And they're simple things that like make sense to us and we know what to do. But I think you do a really good job of explaining, what's working behind the scenes to make it have a bigger impact. So
thank you. That's what I hope to do. And by the way, I mentioned the resources. And, so if you go to theactivatorbook.com, that's going to show you everything about the book and, you can click on the free bonuses. And that's going to take you to all the bonuses that I offer in the book. So lots of things that you can take, even a motives and values quiz, more than 76 ways that you can lead to activate the brain, the framework checklist, all some really good things there for anyone. It's free. You can use that and it'll hopefully help you with your leadership.
Well, that's awesome. We'll put the links in the description for the podcast as well for that as well too. But Jason, thank you a million times for being a guest and for talking with me. Where else can people find you? Obviously theactivatorbook.com, but where else can people find you?
Yeah, you can go to my website, drjasonjones.com. So it's drjasonjones.com, and you can learn lots of stuff there.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Again, thanks for being a pretty guest. For everybody else who is listening, I would go through, I normally try to end with like the couple of things that I've learned, but I've literally got 2.5 pages of things here. It's great stuff. It's wonderful. And what I love again is that, you know, so much of these things are the things that make us human. And the more and more that we can understand each other, the better our relationships will be, the better that we're going to be for other people around. And so that's what I'm excited. Thanks for sharing. And everybody else, like the episode, subscribe, do all the stuff you're supposed to do with that. Looking forward to seeing you on the next episode.